shaped heads that gleamed redly in the light from the burning stables. They were screaming in the old tongue as they stormed the barricade, jabbing with their spears, swinging their bronze axes, spitting corn and blood with equal abandon, while crossbow quarrels and arrows rained down on them from the archers that Donald Noy had posted on the stair. "What do we do?" Satin shouted. "We kill them," John shouted back, a black arrow in his hand. No archer could have asked for an easier shot. The Thens had their backs to the King's Tower as they charged the crescent, clambering over bags and barrels to reach the men in black. Both John and Satin chanced to choose the same target. He had just reached the top of the barricade when an arrow sprouted from his neck and a quarrel between his shoulder blades. Half a heartbeat later, a longsword took him in the belly, and he fell back onto the man behind him. John reached down to his quiver and found it empty again. Satin was winding back his crossbow. He left him to it and went for more arrows, but he hadn't taken more than 3 steps before the trap slammed open 3 feet in front of him. Bloody hell! I never even heard the door break. There was no time to think or plan or shout for help. John dropped his bow, reached back over his shoulder, ripped Longclaw from its sheath, and buried the blade in the middle of the first head to pop out of the tower. Bronze was no match for Valyrian steel. The blow sheared right through the Thens helm and deep into his skull, and he went crashing back down where he'd come from. There were more behind him, John knew from the shouting. He fell back and called a Satin. The next man to make the climb got a quarrel through his cheek. He vanished too. "The oil!" John said. Satin nodded. Together they snatched up the thick quilted pads they'd left beside the fire, lifted the heavy kettle of boiling oil, and dumped it down the hole on the Thens below. The shrieks were as bad as anything he'd ever heard, and Satin looked as if he was going to be sick. John kicked the trapdoor shut, set the heavy iron kettle on top of it, and gave the boy with a pretty face a hard shake. "Wretch, later!" John yelled. "Come!" They had only been gone from the parapets for a few moments, but everything below had changed. A dozen black brothers and a few Molestown men still stood atop the crates and barrels, but the wildlings were swarming over all along the crescent, pushing them back. John saw one shove his spear up through Rast's belly so hard it lifted him into the air. Young Henley was dead, and old Henley was dying, surrounded by foes. He could see Easy, spinning and slashing, laughing like a loon, his cloak flapping as he leapt from cask to cask. A bronze axe caught him just below the knee, and the laughter turned into a bubbling shriek. "They're breaking," Satin said. "No," said John, "they're broken." It happened quickly. One mole fled, then another, and suddenly all the villagers were throwing down their weapons and abandoning the barricade. The brothers were too few to hold alone. John watched them try and form a line to fall back in order, but the Thens washed over them with spear and axe, and then they were fleeing too. Dornish Dilly slipped and went down in his face, and a wildling planted a spear between his shoulder blades. Kegs, slow and short of breath, had almost reached the bottom step when a Then caught the end of his cloak and yanked him around. But a crossbow quarrel dropped the man before his axe could fall. "Gut him," Satin crowed, as Kegs staggered to the stair and began to crawl up the steps on hands and knees. The gate is lost. Donald Noy had closed and chained it, but it was there for the taking, the iron bars glimmering red with reflected firelight, the coal-black tunnel behind. No one had fallen back to defend it. The only safety was on top of the wall, 700 feet up the crooked wooden stairs. "What guards do you pray to?" John asked Satin. "The Seven," the boy from Old Town said. "Pray then," John told him. "Pray to your new gods, and I'll pray to my old ones." It all turned here. With a confusion at the trapdoor, John had forgotten to fill his quiver. He limped back across the roof, and did that now, and picked up his bow as well. The kettle had not moved from where he'd left it, so it seemed as though they were safe enough for the nonce. The dance has moved on. and were watching from the gallery, he thought as he hobbled back. Saturn was loosing quarrels at the wildlings on the steps, then ducking down behind a Merlin to cock the crossbow. He may be pretty, but he's quick. The real battle was on the steps. Noy had put spearmen on the two lowest landings, but the headlong flight of the villagers had panicked them, and they had joined the flight, racing up toward the third landing with the Thens killing anyone who fell behind. The archers and crossbowmen on the higher landings were trying to drop shafts over their heads. John knocked an arrow, drew and loosed, and was pleased when one of the wildlings went rolling down the steps. The heat of the fires was making the wall weep, and the flames danced and shimmered against the ice. The steps shook to the footsteps of men running for their lives. Again John notched and drew and loosed, but there was only one of him and one of Saturn, and a good 60 or 70 Thens pounding up the stairs, killing as they went, drunk on victory. On the fourth landing, three brothers in black cloaks stood shoulder to shoulder with long swords in their hands, and battle was joined again briefly. But there were only three, and soon enough the wilding tide washed over them, and their blood dripped down the steps. A man is never so vulnerable in battle as when he flees, Lord Eddard had told John once. A running man is like a wounded animal to a soldier. It gets his bloodlust up. The archers on the fifth landing fled before the battle even reached them. It was a rout, a red rout. "Fetch the torches," John told Saturn. There were four of them stacked beside the fire, their heads wrapped in oily rags. There were a dozen fire arrows, too. The old town boy thrust one torch into the fire until it was blazing brightly, and brought the rest back under his arm unlit. He looked frightened again, as well he might. John was frightened too. It was then that he saw stir. The Magna was climbing up the barricade over the gutted corn sacks and smashed barrels and the bodies of friends and foe alike. His bronze-scale armour gleamed darkly in the firelight. Stir had taken off his helm to survey the scene of his triumph, and the bald, earless Horson was smiling. In his hand was a long weirwood spear with an ornate bronze head. When he saw the gate, he pointed the spear at it and barked something in the old tongue to the half-dozen Thens around him. "Too late," John thought. "You should have led your men over the barricade. You might have been able to save a few." Up above, a war horn sounded, long and low. Not from the top of the wall, but from the ninth landing, some 200 feet up, where Donal Noy was standing. John notched a fire arrow to his bowstring and sat in lit it from the torch. He stepped to the parapet, drew, aimed, loosed. Ribbons of flame trailed behind as the shaft sped downward and thudded into its target, crackling. Not stir. The steps. Or more precisely, the casks and kegs and sacks that Donal Noy had piled up beneath the steps, as high as the first landing. The barrels of lard and lamp oil, the bags of leaves and oily rags, the split logs, bark, and wood shavings. "Again," said John, "and again, and again." Other longbowmen were firing too, from every tower top in range, some sending their arrows up in high arcs to drop before the wall. When John ran out of fire arrows, he and Saturn began to light the torches and fling them from the crenels. Up above, another fire was blooming. The old wooden steps had drunk up oil like a sponge, and Donal Noy had drenched them from the ninth landing all the way down to the seventh. John could only hope that most of their own people had staggered up to safety before Noy threw the torches. The Black Brothers at least had known the plan, but the villagers had not. Wind and fire did the rest. All John had to do was watch. With flames below and flames above, the wildlings had nowhere to go. Some continued upward and died. Some went downward and died. Some stayed where they were. They died as well. Many leapt from the steps before they burned and died from the fall. 20-odd Thens were still huddled together between the fires when the ice cracked from the heat, and the whole lower third of the stair broke off, along with several tons of ice. That was the last that Jon Snow saw of Styr, the Magnar of Then. "The wall defends itself," he thought. Jon asked Satin to help him down to the yard. His wounded leg hurt so badly that he could hardly walk even with a crutch. "Bring the torch," he told the boy from Oldtown. "I need to look for someone." It had been mostly Thens on the steps. Surely some of the free folk had escaped. Mance's people, not the Magnar's. She might have been one. So they climbed down, past the bodies of the men who'd tried the trapdoor, and Jon wandered through the dark, with his crutch under one arm and the other around the shoulders of a boy who'd been a whore in Oldtown. The stables and the common hall had burned down to smoking cinders by then, but the fire still raged along the wall, climbing step by step and landing by landing. From time to time they'd hear a groan, and then a crack, and another chunk would come crashing off the wall. The air was full of ash and ice crystals. He found Court dead, and Stone Thumbs dying. He found some dead and dying Thens he'd never truly known. He found Big Boil, weak from all the blood he'd lost, but still alive. He found Ygritte, sprawled across a patch of old snow beneath the Lord Commander's tower, with an arrow between her breasts. The ice crystals had settled over her face, and in the moonlight it looked as though she wore a glittering silver mask. The arrow was black, Jon saw, but it was fletched with white duck feathers. "Not mine," he told himself. "Not one of mine." But he felt as if it were. When he knelt in the snow beside her, her eyes opened.
"Jon Snow," she said, very softly. It sounded as though the arrow had found a lung. "Is this a proper castle, no? Not just a tower?"
"It is." Jon took her hand.
"Good," she whispered. "I wanted to see one proper castle before I..."
"You'll see 100 castles," he promised her. "The battle's done. Maester Aemon will see to you." He touched her hair.
"You're kissed by fire, remember? Lucky. It will take more than an arrow to kill you."
"Aemon will draw it out and patch you up, and will get you some milk of the puppy for the pain." She just smiled at that.
"Do you remember that cave? We should have stayed in that cave. I told you so."
"We'll go back to the cave," he said. "You're not going to die, Ygritte. You're not."
"Oh."
Ygritte cupped his cheek with her hand.
"You know nothing, Jon Snow."
She sighed, dying.
The Queen's Guard.
"You were the Queen's men," said Resnick, Mo Resnick. "The King desires his own men about him when he holds court."
"I am the Queen's man still, today, tomorrow, always, until my last breath or hers."
Barristan Selmy refused to believe that Daenerys Targaryen was dead. Perhaps that was why he was being put aside. "One by one, his Dar removes us all." Strong Belwas lingered at the door of death in the temple, under the care of the Blue Graces, though Selmy half suspected they were finishing the job those hunted locusts had begun. Scarhaz Shavepate had been stripped of his command. The Unsullied had withdrawn to their barracks. Jogo, Dario Naharis, Admiral Grolio, and Hero of the Unsullied remained hostages of the Yunkai. Aggo and Ricaro and the rest of the Queen's Khalasar had been dispatched across the river to search for their lost queen. Even Missandei had been replaced. The king did not think it fit to use a child as his herald, and a one-time Na'vi slave at that.
and now me. There was a time when he might have taken this dismissal as a blot upon his honour, but that was in Westeros. In the viper's pit that was Meereen, honour seemed as silly as a fool's motley, and this mistrust was mutual. His Darzo Lorek might be his queen's consort, but he would never be his king.
If his grace wishes for me to remove myself from court,
his radiance, the seneschal corrected. No, 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 you misunderstand me. His worship is to receive a delegation from the Yunkoi to discuss the withdrawal of their armies. They may ask for recompense for those who lost their lives to the dragon's wrath. A delicate situation. The king feels it will be better if they see a Meereenese king upon the throne, protected by Meereenese warriors. Surely you can understand that, sir.
I understand more than you know. Might I know which men His Grace has chosen to protect him?
Resnick, Mo Resnick, smiled his slimy smile.
Fearsome fighters who love his worship well. Gogor the giant, Kras the spotted cap, Bellaquo Bonebreaker, heroes all.
Pit fighters all? Sir Barrister was unsurprised. His Darzo Lorek sat uneasily on his new throne. It had been 1,000 years since Meereen last had a king, and there were some, even amongst the old blood, who thought they might have made a better choice than him. Outside the city sat the Yunkai, with their sellswords and their allies. Inside were the sons of the Harpy. And the king's protectors grew fewer every day. His Dar's blunder with Grey Worm had cost him the Unsullied. When His Grace had tried to put them under the command of a cousin, as he had the Brazen Beasts, Grey Worm had informed the king that they were free men who took commands only from their mother. As for the Brazen Beasts, half were freedmen and the rest shavepates, whose true loyalty might still be to Skaha's Mokandek. The pit fighters were King Hisdar's only reliable support against a sea of enemies.
May they defend His Grace against all threats.
Sir Barristan's tone gave no hint of his true feelings. He had learned to hide such back in King's Landing years ago.
His Magnificence, Resnick Mo Resnick stressed. Your other duties shall remain unchanged, sir. Should this peace fail, His Radiance would still wish for you to command his forces against the enemies of our city.
He has that much sense, at least.
Bellaquo Bonebreaker and Gogor the Giant might serve as Hisdar's shields, but the notion of either leading an army into battle was so ludicrous that the old knight almost smiled.
I am His Grace's to command.
Not Grace, the seneschal complained. That style is Westerosi. His Magnificence, His Radiance, His Worship.
His Vanity would fit better. As you say. Resnick licked his lips.
Then we are done.
This time his oily smile betokened dismissal. Sir Barristan took his leave, grateful to leave the stench of the seneschal's perfume behind him.
A man should smell of sweat, not flowers.
The Great Pyramid of Meereen was 800 feet high from base to point. The seneschal's chambers were on the second level. The queen's apartments and his own occupied the highest step.
A long climb for a man my age, Sir Barristan thought, as he started up.
He had been known to make that climb 5 or 6 times a day on the queen's business, as the aches in his knees and the small of his back could attest.
There will come a day when I can no longer face these steps, he thought, and that day will be here sooner than I would like.
Before it came, he must make certain that at least a few of his lads were ready to take his place at the queen's side.
I will knight them myself when they are worthy, and give them each a horse and golden spurs.
The royal apartments were still and silent.
Hisdar had not taken up residence there, preferring to establish his own suite of rooms deep in the heart of the Great Pyramid, where massive brick walls surrounded him on all sides. Mizara Miklas and Kezar, and the rest of the Queen's young cupbearers, hostages in truth, but both Selmy and the Queen had become so fond of them that it was hard for him to think of them that way, had gone with the King, whilst Eri and Jiqui departed with the other Dothraki. Only Missandei remained, a forlorn little ghost haunting the Queen's chambers at the apex of the pyramid. Sir Barristan walked out onto the terrace. The sky above Meereen was the colour of corpse flesh, dull and white and heavy, a mass of unbroken cloud from horizon to horizon. The sun was hidden behind a wall of cloud. It would set unseen, as it had risen unseen that morning. The night would be hot, a sweaty, suffocating, sticky sort of night without a breath of air. For 3 days rain had threatened, but not a drop had fallen.
Rain would come as a relief. It might help wash the city clean.
From here he could see 4 lesser pyramids, the city's western walls and the camps of the Yunkish men by the shores of Slaver's Bay, where a thick column of greasy smoke twisted upwards like some monstrous serpent.
"Ah, the Yunkish men burning their dead," he realized. "A pale mare is galloping through their siege camps."
Despite all the Queen had done, the sickness had spread both within the city walls and without. Meereen's markets were closed, its streets empty. King Hisdar had allowed the fighting pits to remain open, but the crowds were sparse. The Meereenese had even begun to shun the Temple of the Graces, reportedly.
"The slavers will find some way to blame Daenerys for that as well,"
Sir Barristan thought bitterly. He could almost hear them whispering, great masters, sons of the Harpy, Yunkai, all telling one another that his queen was dead. Half of the city believed it, though as yet they did not have the courage to say such words aloud.
"But soon, I think."
Sir Barristan felt very tired, very old.
"Where have all the years gone?"
Of late, whenever he knelt to drink from a still pool, he saw a stranger's face gazing up from the water's depths. When had those crow's feet first appeared around his pale blue eyes? How long ago had his hair turned from sunlight into snow?
"Years ago, old man, decades."
Yet it seemed like only yesterday that he had been raised to knighthood after the tourney at King's Landing. He could still recall the touch of King Aegon's sword upon his shoulder, light as a maiden's kiss. His words had caught in his throat when he spoke his vows. At the feast that night, he had eaten ribs of wild boar, prepared the Dornish way with dragon peppers, so hot they burned his mouth. 47 years, and the taste still lingered in his memory. Yet he could not have said what he supped on 10 days ago if all 7 kingdoms had depended on it.
"Boiled dog? Most like. Or some other foul dish that tasted no better?"
Not for the first time, Selmy wondered at the strange fates that had brought him here. He was a knight of Westeros, a man of the Stormlands and the Dornish Marches. His place was in the 7 kingdoms, not here, upon the sweltering shores of Slaver's Bay.
"I came to bring Daenerys home."
Yet he had lost her, just as he had lost her father and her brother.
"Even Robert, I failed him too."
Perhaps Hisdar was wiser than he knew.
10 years ago, I would have sensed what Daenerys meant to do. 10 years ago, I would have been quick enough to stop her."
Instead, he had stood befuddled as she leapt into the pit, shouting her name, then running uselessly after her across the scarlet sands.
"I am become old and slow,"
Small wonder Naharis mocked him as Sir Grandfather.
Would Dario have moved more quickly if he had been beside the Queen that day?
Selmy thought he knew the answer to that, although it was not one he liked. He had dreamed of it again last night. Belwas on his knees, retching up bile and blood, Hisdar urging on the dragon slayers, men and women fleeing in terror, fighting on the steps, climbing over one another, screaming and shouting, and Daenerys.
Her hair was aflame. She had the whip in her hand, and she was shouting. Then she was on the dragon's back, flying.
The sand that Drogon stirred as he took wing had stung Sir Barristan's eyes. But to a veil of tears, he had watched the beast fly from the pit, his great black wings slapping at the shoulders of the bronze warriors at the gates. The rest he learned later. Beyond the gates had been a solid press of people. Maddened by the smell of dragon, horses below reared in terror, lashing out with iron-shod hooves. Food stalls and palanquins alike were overturned, men knocked down and trampled. Spears were thrown, crossbows were fired. Some struck home. The dragon twisted violently in the air, wounds smoking, the girl clinging to his back. Then he loosed the fire. It had taken the rest of the day and most of the night for the brazen beasts to gather up the corpses. The final count was 214 slain, three times as many burned or wounded. Drogon was gone from the city by then, last seen high over the Skahazadan, flying north. Of Daenerys Targaryen, no trace had been found. Some swore they had seen her fall. Others insisted that the dragon had carried her off to devour her.
They are wrong.
Sir Barristan knew no more of dragons than the tales every child hears. But he knew Targaryens. Daenerys had been riding that dragon, as Aegon had once ridden Balerion of old.
"She might be flying home," he told himself aloud. "No," murmured a soft voice behind him. "She would not do that, sir. She would not go home without us."
Sir Barristan turned.
"Missandei, child, how long have you been standing there?"
"Not long. This one is sorry if she has disturbed you."
She hesitated.
"Skahaz Mokandak wishes words with you."
"The shave pate. You spoke with him?"
"Oh, that was rash. The enmity ran deep between Skahaz and the king, and the girl was clever enough to know that. Skahaz had been outspoken in his opposition to the queen's marriage, a fact Hisdar had not forgotten.
"Is he here, in the pyramid?"
"When he wishes, he comes and goes, sir."
"Yes, he would. Who told you he wants words with me?"
"A brazen beast. He wore an owl mask."
"He wore an owl mask when he spoke to you. By now he could be a jackal, a tiger, a sloth."
Sir Barristan had hated the mask from the start, and never more than now. Honest men should never need to hide their faces. And the shave pate?
What could he be thinking?
After Hisdar had given command of the brazen beast to his cousin, Margaz Zolorek, Skahaz had been named warden of the river, with charge of all the ferries, dredges, and irrigation ditches along the Skahazadan for 50 leagues. But the shave pate had refused that ancient and honourable office, as Hisdar called it, preferring to retire to the modest pyramid of Kandak.
"Without the queen to protect him, he takes a great risk coming here."
And if Sir Barristan were seen speaking with him, suspicion might fall on the knight as well. He did not like the taste of this. It smelled of deceit, of whispers and lies and plots hatched in the dark. All the things he hoped to leave behind with the spider and Lord Littlefinger and their ilk. Barristan Selmy was not a bookish man, but he had often glanced through the pages of the White Book, where the deeds of his predecessors had been recorded. Some had been heroes, some weaklings, knaves or cravens, Most were only men, quicker and stronger than most, more skilled with sword and shield, but still prey to pride, ambition, lust, love, anger, jealousy, greed for gold, hunger for power, and all the other failings that afflicted lesser mortals. The best of them overcame their flaws, did their duty, and died with their swords in their hands. The worst?
The worst were those who played the Game of Thrones. "Can you find this owl again?" he asked Miss Andy.
"This one can try, sir. Tell him I will speak with our friend after dark by the stables."
The pyramid's main doors were closed and barred at sunset. The stables would be quiet at that hour.
"Make certain it is the same owl."
It would not serve to have the wrong brazen beast hear of this.
"This one understands."
Miss Andy turned as if to go, then paused for a moment and said,
"It is said that the Yunkai have ringed the city all about with scorpions to loose iron bolts into the sky should Drogon return."
Sir Barristan had heard that too.
"It is no simple thing to slay a dragon in the sky. In Westeros, many tried to bring down Aegon and his sisters. None succeeded."
Miss Andy nodded. It was hard to tell if she was reassured.
"Do you think that they will find her, sir? The grasslands are so vast, and dragons leave no tracks across the sky. Aego and Ricaro are blood of her blood, and who knows they Dothraki see better than Dothraki?"
He squeezed her shoulder.
"They will find her, if she can be found, if she still lives."
There were other carles who prowled the grass, horse lords with khalasars whose riders numbered in the tens of thousands. But the girl did not need to hear that.
"You love her well, I know. I swear I shall keep her safe."
The words seemed to give the girl some comfort.
"Words are wind, though," Sir Barristan thought. "How can I protect the queen when I am not with her?"
Barristan Selmy had known many kings. He had been born during the troubled reign of Aegon the Unlikely, beloved by the common folk, had received his knighthood at his hands. Aegon's son Jaehaerys had bestowed the white cloak on him when he was 23, after he slew Maelys the Monstrous during the War of the Ninepenny Kings. In that same cloak he had stood beside the Iron Throne as madness consumed Jaehaerys' son Aerys.
"Stood and saw and heard, and yet did nothing."
But no, that was not fair. He did his duty. Some nights Sir Barristan wondered if he had not done that duty too well. He had sworn his vows before the eyes of gods and men. He could not in honour go against them. But the keeping of those vows had grown hard in the last years of King Aerys' reign. He had seen things that it pained him to recall, and more than once he wondered how much of the blood was on his own hands. If he had not gone into Duskendale to rescue Aerys from Lord Darkland's dungeons, the king might well have died there as Tywin Lannister sacked the town. Then Prince Rhaegar would have ascended the Iron Throne, mayhaps to heal the realm. Duskendale had been his finest hour, yet the memory tasted bitter on his tongue. It was his failures that haunted him at night, though. Jaehaerys, Aerys, Robert, three dead kings. Rhaegar, who would have been a finer king than any of them. Princess Elia and the children. Aegon, just a babe. Rhaenys with her kitten. Dead, everyone. Yet he still lived, who had sworn to protect them. And now Daenerys, his bright, shining child queen.
"She is not dead. I will not believe it."
Afternoon brought Sir Barristan a brief respite from his doubts. He spent it in the training hall on the pyramid's third level, working with his boys, teaching them the art of sword and shield, horse and lance, and chivalry. the code that made a knight more than any pit fighter. Daenerys would need protectors her own age about her after he was gone, and Sir Barristan was determined to give her such. The lads he was instructing ranged in age from 8 to 20. He had started with more than 60 of them, but the training had proved too rigorous for many. Less than half that number now remained, but some showed great promise.
"With no king to guard, I will have more time to train them now," he realized,
as he walked from pair to pair, watching them go at one another with blunted swords and spears with rounded heads.
"Brave boys, base-born, aye, but some will make good knights, and they love the queen. If not for her, all of them would have ended in the pits. King Hesdar has his pit fighters, but Daenerys will have knights." "Keep your shield up," he called. "Show me your strokes. Together now, low, high, low, low, high, low."
Selmy took his simple supper out onto the Queen's Terrace that night and ate it as the sun went down. Through the purple twilight, he watched fires waken one by one in the great stepped pyramids, as the many-coloured bricks of Meereen faded to grey and then to black. Shadows gathered in the streets and alleys below, making pools and rivers. In the dusk, the city seemed a tranquil place, even beautiful.
"That is pestilence, not peace," the old knight told himself, with his last sip of wine.
He did not wish to be conspicuous, so when he was finished with his supper, he changed out of his court clothes, trading the white cloak of the Queen's Guard for a hooded brown traveller's cloak, such as any common man might wear. He kept his sword and dagger.
This could still be some trap. He had little trust in Hesdar, and less in Resnek Moresnek.
The perfumed seneschal could well be part of this, trying to lure him into a secret meeting, so he could sweep up him and Skahas both and charge them with conspiring against the king.
"If the shavepate speaks treason, he will leave me no choice but to arrest him. Hesdar is my queen's consort. However little I may like it, my duty is to him, not Skahas."
Or was it?
The first duty of the king's guard was to defend the king from harm or threat. The white knights were sworn to obey the king's commands as well, to keep his secrets, counsel him when counsel was requested, and keep silent when it was not, serve his pleasure, and defend his name and honour. Strictly speaking, it was purely the king's choice whether or not to extend king's guard protection to others, even those of royal blood. Some kings thought it right and proper to dispatch Kingsguard to serve and defend their wives and children, siblings, aunts, uncles, and cousins of greater and lesser degree, and occasionally even their lovers, mistresses, and bastards. But others preferred to use household knights and men-at-arms for those purposes, whilst keeping their seven as their own personal guards, never far from their sides. "If the queen had commanded me to protect Hesdar, I would have had no choice but to obey."
But Daenerys Targaryen had never established a proper queen's guard, even for herself, nor issued any commands in respect to her consort.
"The world was simpler when I had a lord commander to decide such matters," Selmy reflected. "Now I am the lord commander, and it is hard to know which path is right."
When at last he came to the bottom of the last flight of steps, he found himself all but alone amongst the torch-lit corridors inside the pyramid's massive brick walls. The great gates were closed and barred, as he had anticipated. Four brazen beasts stood guard outside those doors, four more within. It was those that the old knight encountered, big men, masters Boar, Bear, Vole, and Manticore.
"All quiet, sir,"
the bear told him.
"Keep it so."
It was not unknown for Sir Barristan to walk around at night to make certain the pyramid was secure. Deeper inside the pyramid, another four brazen beasts had been set to guard the iron doors outside the pit where Viserion and Rhaegal were chained. The light of the torches shimmered off their masks, ape, ram, wolf, crocodile.
"Have they been fed?"
Sir Barristan asked.
"Aye, sir," replied the ape. "A sheep apiece."
"And how long will that suffice, I wonder?"
As the dragons grew, so did their appetites. It was time to find the shave pate. Sir Barristan made his way past the elephants and the queen's silver mare to the back of the stables. An ass nickered as he went by, and a few of the horses stirred at the light of his lantern. Elsewise, all was dark and silent. Then a shadow detached itself from inside an empty stall and became another brazen beast, clad in pleated black skirt, greaves, and muscled breastplate.
"A cat," said Barristan Selmy, when he saw the brass beneath the hood. When the shave pate had command of the brazen beast, he had favoured a serpent's head mask, imperious and frightening.
"Cats go everywhere,"
replied the familiar voice of Skahaz Mokandak.
"No one ever looks at them."
"If Histar should learn that you are here..."
"Who will tell him? Margaz? Margaz knows what I want him to know. The beasts are still mine. Do not forget it."
The shave-pate's voice was muffled by his mask, but Selmy could hear the anger in it.
"I have the poisoner."
"Who?"
"Hizdar's confectioner. His name would mean nothing to you. The man was just a cat's paw. The sons of the Arpi took his daughter and swore she would be returned unarmed once the queen was dead. Belmars and the dragon saved Daenerys. No one saved the girl. She was returned to her father in the Black of Night in 9 pieces, one for every year she lived."
"Why?"
Doubts gnawed at him. "The sons had stopped their killing. Hizdar's peace
is a shame." "Not at first, no. The Yunkai were afraid of our queen, of her unsullied, of her dragons. This land has known dragons before. Yerkaz O'Yunzek had read his histories, he knew. Hizdar as well. Why not a peace? Daenerys wanted it, they could see that. Wanted it too much. She should have marched to Astapor."
Skahaz moved closer.
"That was before. The pit changed all. Daenerys gone. Yerkaz dead. In place of one old lion, a pack of jackals. Bloodbeard. That one has no taste for peace. And there is more, worse. Valantis has launched its fleet against us."
"Valantis?"
Selmy's sword hand tingled.
"We made a peace with Yunkai, not with Valantis. You are certain?"
"Certain. The wise masters know. So do their friends. The Arpi, Resnek, Hizdar. This king will open the city gates to the Valentines when they arrive. All those Daenerys freed will be enslaved again. Even some who were never slaves will be fitted for chains. You may end your days in a fighting pit, old man. Kras will eat your heart."
His head was pounding.
"Daenerys must be told."
"Find her first."
Skahaz grasped his forearm. His fingers felt like iron.
"We cannot wait for her. I've spoken with the Free Brothers, the Mother's Men, the Stalwart Shields. They have no trust in Lorik. We must break the Yunkai, but we need the Unsullied. Grey Worm will listen to you. Speak to him."
"To what end?" "He is speaking treason, conspiracy."
"Life."
The shave-pate's eyes were black pools behind the brazen cat mask.
"We must strike before Valentines arrive. Break the siege. Kill the slaver lords. Turn their sellswords. The Yunkai do not expect an attack. I have spies in their camps. Their sickness, they say, worse every day. Discipline has gone to rot. The lords are drunk more often than not, gorging themselves at feasts, telling each other of the riches they'll divide when Meereen falls. squabbling over primacy. Bloodbeard and the Tattered Prince despise each other. No one expects a fight. Not now. Hisdar's peace has lulled us to sleep, they believe.
Daenerys signed that peace,
Sir Barristan said.
It is not for us to break it without her leave.
And if she is dead? Demanded Scars. What then, sir? I say she would want us to protect her city, her children.
Her children were the freedmen. Mysa, they called her, all those whose chains she broke. Mother. The shave pate was not wrong. Daenerys would want her children protected. What of Hisdar? He is still her consort, her king, her husband.
Her poisoner.
Is he? Where is your proof?
The crown he wears is proof enough. The throne he sits. Open your eyes, old man. That is all he needed from Daenerys. All he ever wanted. Once he had it, why share the rule?
Why, indeed?
It had been so hot down in the pit, he could still see the air shimmering above the scarlet sands, smell the blood spilling from the men who died for their amusement. And he could still hear Hisdar urging his queen to try the honeyed locust.
Those are very tasty, sweet and hot. Yet he never touched so much as one himself.
Selmy rubbed his temple.
I swore no vows to Hisdar Zolorek, and if I had, he has cast me aside, just as Joffrey did. This confectioner, I want to question him myself, alone.
Is it that way?
The shavepate crossed his arms against his chest.
Done, then. Question him as you like.
If what he has to say convinces me, if I join with you in I would require your word that no harm would come to Hisdar Zolorek unless it can be proved that he had some part in this.
Why do you care so much for Hisdar, old man? If he is not the RP, he is the RP's firstborn son.
All I know for certain is that he is the Queen's consort. I want your word on this, or I swear I shall oppose you.
Skaha's smile was savage.
My word, then. No harm to Hisdar till his guilt is proved. But when we have the proof, I mean to kill him with my own hands. I want to pull his entrails out and show them to him before I let him die.
No, the old knight thought. If Hisdar conspired at my queen's death, I will see to him myself. But his death will be swift and clean.
The guards of Westeros were far away, yet Sir Barristan Selmy paused for a moment to say a silent prayer, asking the crone to light his way to wisdom.
For the children, he told himself, for the city, for my queen. I will talk to Grey Worm, he said.
Bran.
It's only another empty castle,
Mira Reed said as she gazed across the desolation of rubble, ruins, and weeds. No, thought Bran, it is the Night Fort, and this is the end of the world. In the mountains, all he could think of was reaching the wall and finding the three-eyed crow. But now that they were here, he was filled with fears. The dream he'd had, the dream that Summer had had. No, I mustn't think about that dream. He had not even told the Reeds, though Mira at least seemed to sense that something was wrong. If he never talked of it, maybe he could forget he ever dreamed it, and then it wouldn't have happened. And Rob and Grey Wind would still be... Hodor! Hodor shifted his weight and Bran with it. He was tired. They had been walking for hours. At least he's not afraid. Bran was scared of this place and almost as scared of admitting it to the Reeds. I'm a prince of the North, a Stark of Winterfell, almost a man grown.
I have to be as brave as Rob. Jojen gazed up at him with his dark green eyes.
There's nothing here to hurt us, Your Grace.
Bran wasn't so certain. The Night Fort had figured in some of old Nan's scariest stories. It was here that Night's King had reigned, before his name was wiped from the memory of man. This was where the Rat Cook had served the Andal King his prince and bacon pie, where the 79 Sentinels stood their watch, where brave young Danny Flint had been raped and murdered. This was a castle where King Sherritt had called down his curse on the Andals of old, where the Prentice boys had faced the thing that came in the night, where blind Simeon Star Eyes had seen the hellhounds fighting. Mad Axe had once walked these yards and climbed these towers, butchering his brothers in the dark. All that had happened hundreds and thousands of years ago, to be sure, and some maybe never happened at all. Maester Lewin always said that old Nan's stories shouldn't be swallowed whole. But once his uncle came to see Father, and Bran asked about the Night Fort. Benjen Stark never said the tales were true, but he never said they weren't. He only shrugged and said, "We left the Night Fort 200 years ago," as if that was an answer. Bran forced himself to look around. The morning was cold but bright, the sun shining down from a hard blue sky, but he did not like the noises. The wind made a nervous whistling sound as it shivered through the broken towers. The keeps groaned and settled, and he could hear rats scrabbling under the floor of the great hall. The Rat Cook's children running from their father. The yards were small forests where spindly trees rubbed their bare branches together and dead leaves scuttled like roaches across patches of old snow. There were trees growing where the stables had been, and a twisted white weirwood pushing up through the gaping hole in the roof of the domed kitchen. Even summer was not at ease here. Bran slipped inside his skin, just for an instant, to get the smell of the place. He did not like that either. And there was no way through. Bran had told them there wouldn't be. He had told them and told them. But Jojen Reed had insisted on seeing for himself. He had had a green dream, he said, and his green dreams did not lie. They don't open any gates either, thought Bran. The gate the Night Fort guarded had been sealed since the day the Black Brothers had loaded up their mules and garrons and departed for Deep Lake. Its iron portcullis lowered, the chains that raised it carried off, the tunnel packed with stone and rubble all frozen together until they were as impenetrable as the wall itself. We should have followed John, Bran said when he saw it. He thought of his bastard brother often, since the night that Summer had watched him ride off through the storm. We should have found the King's Road and gone to Castle Black.
We dare not, my prince, Jojen said. I've told you why. But there are wildlings. They killed some man, and they wanted to kill John too. Jojen, there were 100 of them. So you said. We are 4. You helped your brother, if that was him in truth, but it almost cost you Summer.
I know, Bran said miserably. The direwolf had killed 3 of them, maybe more, but there had been too many. When they formed a tight ring around the tall, earless man, he had tried to slip away through the rain, but one of their arrows had come flashing after him, and the sudden stab of pain had driven Bran out of the wolfskin and back into his own. After the storm finally died, they had huddled in the dark without a fire, talking in whispers, if they talked at all, listening to Hodor's heavy breathing and wondering if the wildlings might try and cross the lake in the morning. Bran had reached out for Summer time and time again, but the pain he found drove him back, the way a red-hot kettle makes you pull your hand back even when you mean to grab it. Only Hodor slept that night, muttering, "Hodor, Hodor," as he tossed and turned. Bran was terrified that Summer was off, dying in the darkness. "Please, you old gods," he prayed. "You took Winterfell and my father and my legs. Please don't take Summer too. And watch over Jon Snow too. And make these wildlings go away." No weirwoods grew on that stony island in the lake, yet somehow the old gods must have heard. The wildlings took their sweet time about departing the next morning, stripping the bodies of their dead and the old man they'd killed, even pulling a few fish from the lake. And there was a scary moment when three of them found the causeway and started to walk out. But the path turned, and they didn't, and two of them nearly drowned before the others pulled them out. The tall, bald man yelled at them, his words echoing across the water in some tongue that even Jojen did not know. And a little while later, they gathered up their shields and spears and marched off north by east, the same way John had gone. Bran wanted to leave too, to look for Summer, but the reed said no.
"We will stay another night," said Jojen. "Put some leagues between us and the wildlings. You don't want to meet them again, do you?"
Late that afternoon, Summer returned from wherever he'd been hiding, dragging his back leg. He ate parts of the bodies in the inn, driving off the crows, then swam out to the island. Mira had drawn the broken arrow from his leg and rubbed the wound with the juice of some plants she'd found growing around the base of the tower. The direwolf was still limping, but a little less each day, it seemed to Bran. The guards had heard.
"Maybe we should try another castle," Mira said to her brother. "Maybe we could get through the gate somewhere else. I could go scout if you wanted. I'd make better time by myself."
Bran shook his head.
"If you go east, there's Deep Lake, then Queensgate. West is Icemark. But they'll be the same, only smaller. All the gates are sealed, except the ones at Castle Black, Eastwatch, and the Shadow Tower."
Hodor said, "Hodor," to that, and the reeds exchanged a look.
"At least I should climb to the top of the wall," Mira decided. "Maybe I'll see something up there." "What could you hope to see?" Jojen asked. "Something," said Mira, and for once she was adamant.
"It should be me." Bran raised his head to look up at the wall and imagined himself climbing inch by inch, squirming his fingers into cracks in the ice and kicking footholds with his toes. That made him smile, in spite of everything. The dreams and the wildlings and John and everything. He had climbed the walls of Winterfell when he was little, and all the towers too, but none of them had been so high. And they were only stone. The wall could look like stone, all grey and pitted, but then the clouds would break, and the sun would hit it differently, and all at once it would transform and stand there white and blue and glittering. It was the end of the world, old Nan always said. On the other side were monsters and giants and ghouls, but they could not pass so long as the wall stood strong. "I want to stand on top with Mira," Bran thought. "I want to stand on top and see." But he was a broken boy with useless legs, so all he could do was watch from below as Mira went up in his stead. She wasn't really climbing the way he used to climb. She was only walking up some steps that the Night's Watch had hewn hundreds and thousands of years ago. He remembered Maester Luwin saying the Night Fort was the only castle where the steps had been cut from the ice of the wall itself. Or maybe it had been Uncle Benjen. The newer castles had wooden steps, or stone ones, or long ramps of earth and gravel. "Ice is too treacherous." It was his uncle who told him that. He said that the outer surface of the wall wept icy tears sometimes, though the core inside stayed frozen, hard as rock. The steps must have melted and refrozen a thousand times since the last Black Brothers left the castle, and every time they did, they shrunk a little and got smoother and rounder and more treacherous. And smaller. It's almost like the wall was swallowing them back into itself. Mira Reed was very sure-footed, but even so she was going slowly, moving from nub to nub. In two places where the steps were hardly there at all, she got down on all fours. "It will be worse when she comes down," Bran thought,